All right. Well, thanks for the introduction, Mike. I want to thank Paisley as well for the invitation to come here. It's an honor to be at this presentation. I want to get you in this 30 minutes to think, to talk about some of your perceptions, right? What goes on related to drought management? I'm not going to give you a lot of great information, advice, but I want you to look at your own operation. Look at your enterprise. What are you doing, and what are some things that might be done differently in your operation? What I'm going to do is, we got a lot of decisions to make out there, right? And what's your horizon look like, and what's your perception of that horizon through your filter or through your lens? So with that today, what I want to do is take a look, and we're going to do some analogy with sunrises and sunsets to look at horizons and your perceptions. I'm going to talk a little bit about drought planning, right? I'm going to talk some about what you can do in your operation to increase flexibility to handle droughts, some adaptive management aspects of what you could do during and after drought, and then we'll wrap up with some tools that we can add to your toolbox to help you with decision making, whether that's current conditions or some longer term forecast. So with that, here's my challenge to you. Right, we're going to talk about drought, but I want to talk about perceptions. We're all looking at the similar horizon there. So what are some words that come to your mind when you look at that? So come to mind is, for me, is connection with the land, right? Could be your homestead, getting up in the morning. That's your place, right? You have long history, multi-generations with that place. And it could be inspiration. It's the start of a new day, right? So again, perceptions of what's going on your similar horizon. How about this one? This was taken off the front porch of my mom and dad's place, fifth generation ranch kid back in the sand hills in Nebraska, looking to the east in the morning. Renewal, right? It's a new day. Something's going to happen. What happened in the past is bygone, but now we start to plan and look for the future. And again, changing perceptions. As that horizon changes, as that sunrise changes, we get different colors, different hues, different aspects. So it's, again, thinking through your lens and what we look at. How about this? Right? What do we see out there? We look at this horizon. What's your perception? Could be cool textures, right? Gray clouds. We've got the fence posts there. Hues and shades of the colors. Right? Everybody's got a different interpretation or perception of what's going on that horizon. And lastly, looking at the iconic symbol of rangelands, right? This windmill on the horizon as the sun sets. Boy, at the end of the day, fulfillment. What did I get done? What did I check off? That to-do list is much smaller. I feel satisfied that I got something done. And then a true satisfaction, if you will, of a day's work done good. Now, I'm going to challenge you as we look at this analogy using sunrises and sunsets. How do we look at drought, right? And everybody's going to look at drought and drought management through a different lens because of your perceptions. Here's a 20th century droughts, right? And we have a history of these, right? These are iconic legacies related to agricultural production in the U.S. Everybody's heard of the 1930s drought, the Dust Bowl, one of the iconic pictures there in the upper left. Right? Some may have even read the book, The Worst Hard Time. If you haven't, that's a great read in looking at the social aspects of what was going on during those drought times. The 1950s drought chronicled well in Elmer Kelton's book, The Time It Never Rained. Again, the social aspects, trying to manage through a period where you just could not get a rainfall event to occur. But we all have a similar horizon, but we have different perspectives, a different lens of what went on based on perhaps our grandfather, father, or others that have multi-generations on your ranch, or if you're a newcomer to the ranch, these are the legacies which, again, are embedded in how we manage for drought because of this what's happened in the past. More recently, 2012, say the word, say the number, everybody has a story, a perception about 2012. It was a major drought, impacted primarily the Western Great Plains the hardest, but the entire U.S. was largely declared a drought disaster area. Talk about a major impact in terms of how we perceive drought and how it influences our drought management options. For those from Montana and Western South Dakota and North Dakota, your perception is clearly impacted by what's happened this year in 2017. You went from a very good spring to boom, almost instantaneously in one of the worst droughts in that part of the world. So again, your lens is filtered through what's been happening in recent time periods. So how do we do planning for drought? And everybody has this X-step plan. I'm going to tell you some simple things. Have some fun and humor with it. Jerry Palin cartoon here. just get back to a nice drought year, right? Wouldn't that be nice to have a normal year instead of 2012, something like 2017 rise up and bite us? This is what I came to Cheyenne in 2002, thanks to Mike, came up there from Texas. This is my first year. That's an enclosure cage. It was put out in 1st of May. We went there to clip it in mid-July. That's what we had for production. Boy, I could really plan for drought, right? That's the wrong time, right, to be planning for drought, right? We want to continually be looking at a drought plan and have that an iterative process, especially as we look at this in terms of experiential time periods. And we know we have drought because, guess what? We have interannual variability. We know that we have tremendous changes in terms of what goes on related to seasonal precipitation, yearly precipitation, warm springs, dry springs, nice falls, etc. But what do we really know from the industry side related to drought? So we did a survey in 2012, in the winter 2012, fortunately, following the major drought of 2012, with wiring producers. And we said, tell us about your perceptions of drought. What do you do? What are your strategies? What's worked? What hasn't? Guess what? We found out that only 6 in 10 of the wiring producers had a drought plan. Lots of opportunities there. 4 in 10 didn't have a drought plan, and this is following a period of 2000, 2002, 4, 6, and now 12 droughts. Right? So what's going on? We need to look at having a plan. We need to have it written down. It needs to be well communicated with everybody in that operation. Do you have some trigger dates? Right? What's going on that impacts decision-making relating to your ranch and your full business enterprise? And is that well communicated amongst everybody in that operation? We've talked and worked with a lot of ranchers over my 15-plus years here in Wyoming and Colorado. I'm going to glean some nuggets of discussions we've had with some of those individuals. Individual here says, yeah, I've got a drought plan. It's fairly pessimistic, right? We do things on a very conservative level because we have this high interannual variability. We know when drought comes, it's going to hit us. Hopefully, it doesn't hit us as hard as everybody else. And we run a smaller cow herd than we probably should. We're conservative, right? We're bracing. We have some flexibility in that system to obtain levels of which when drought comes, we don't have to sell as much as maybe somebody else does. And we know from the survey response on the left there in the blue boxes, what do folks do in terms of proactively planning for drought? Right? The red there is simple. What happens when drought happens? We respond, and we have all these negative things that everybody does. There's economic considerations. But for us, on the left side with the blue is, what can we do? What are some great strategies out there for drought planning? And we saw that about half of the ranchers in Wyoming stock conservatively, again, embracing that approach. They rest pastures deliberately, again, as kind of a insurance policy, if you will. About 1 in 4 or 1 in 5, about 22%, were grass banking, working with cooperatively with neighbors or other entities to utilize their grass during drought periods. We saw that others tried to vary stock rate with the forage supply, so matching animal demand with what's out there. And how do they do that? Well, about 1 in 4 utilize yearlings in their operation to be flexible. Interesting to me is only about 1 in 6 are trying to use any sort of weather predictions to help them with management decisions. Gives us a lot of capacity in the system if we can increase the accuracy, the precision of those weather forecasts to help with decision making, especially in these highly variable systems that we operate in. And here's one, kind of a nugget of information one of the producers shared with us. Drought isn't always bad. It's an opportunity to influence change in your operation. A catalyst, if you will, to make changes that you typically or ordinarily wouldn't do. It doesn't have to be reactive, but it could be a way of looking at your entire operation and saying, wow, we really need to make that change, and drought was the instigator of that change for our operation. The producer also said that last drought, and this was in 2012, was an expensive education to do something different. I think we've all been there, right? Try to feed our way through drought, try to do different things, but ultimately, coming out of that drought, what is it that we'd have done differently? How is it going to impact our operation? And can we see drought as an opportunity to make continual improvement in our operations? Several of the producers we've been working with are talking about operational flexibility. So what can they do at the ranch level to help drought-proof their system, if they will? A couple of the ranchers said, well, we've got to have a diverse type of livestock. That helps us, right, in terms of destocking decisions. Because we know, first and foremost, all the cow-calf producers in here, it's really hard to sell cows. Cow genetics are something that you spent generations building, matching that cow herd to your environment. Last thing you want to try and do is sell cows, especially when you have a drought, because usually the prices are going down. So what else could you do on your operation to get rid of animals? Well, one is perhaps to use yearlings, because guess what? We're not married to those, right? They're a lot easier to get rid of. They're kind of like high school kids going off to college. There's a door. Go on out. And I said, we'll see you later when you need to do laundry, perhaps. But there are a lot more flexibility, and that's some inherent decisions, right? Some perceptions that you might include into your drought decision-making for your individual operation. All right, so here's forage production, and the graph doesn't show up, unfortunately. But guess what? This is 35 years of data from Cheyenne here. We collect biomass data every year. And, boy, we've had some really good years. We could probably name them off, and we could have some really bad years. Guess what? 2000, 2002, 2012. The kicker is, boy, it's really hard in these very variable systems to be able to match, right, animal demand with forage supply when forage supply is doing this sort of thing, right? So how do you do that sort of operationally? Well, guess what? Here's some strategies we've gleaned from visiting with ranchers across the Northern Plains and a lot of different events such as this. We've seen several operations tell us, guess what? We used to be a pure cow-calf business. We got tired of trying to sell cows when it was dry and buy them back or retain more heifers, and we got dinged on both sides because we were selling cheap cows or buying expensive replacements back. We just cut our cow herd down and said, what could we get by with? That is a safe number that gets us through most of the tough years. Several of us have told us about two-thirds of their forage supply on a long-term basis now set aside for the cows. And the rest is then flexed with yearlings or other types of animals. What it does is, one, reduces having to sell those cows, right, during the dry years when everybody else is having to do it. Here's some things also. You can retain more heifer calves in the fall rather than selling those right off the bat and just keeping replacements. Keep all those heifers if you have the winter forage available. If it comes spring, it's a good year. Keep them. You could breed them. You could run them on grass. And then you could sell them to feed yard later if you needed to. If it turns out dry, again, here's that yearling that could be pushed right out the door. Sell it or go straight to the feed yard. Flexibility in the system is built in this way. A novel one we visit with a rancher up in Montana says, I buy all those cheap dry cows that everybody sells after they calve in the spring. And I have extra grass, and I put a lot of weight on them, sell them in the midsummer when dry cows, market cows are up high, and guess what? I make a pretty good ton of money by doing this in terms of flexibility in my system. So again, the point here is that everybody is going to do something different. We're all looking at the same landscapes. We're looking at drought through the same sort of lens, but your perception of that drought and what you do in terms of your operation is going to be as varied as the individuals are in this audience today. If we go with some sort of flexibility in the system, there are economic advantages. Some very nice work here done by Alan Terrell down at New Mexico State University, similar work done by John Ritten here at the University of Wyoming, shows that if you move from a traditional cow-calf-only business over on the left where you have conservative stocking only, this is on a typical ranch in the short grass prairie region of the Western Great Plains. On that ranch, typically over 30 years, they would return about $55,000. If you went and you were able to flex animals up and down with the forage supply and you had cow-calf plus yearlings, overall that comparison netted you $60,000 more or a doubling of your investment on the same amount of land by adding some flexibility to your system. Okay. Now, this is largely contingent on being able to match the forage supply, right, with the difference in animal numbers and having some good forecasts that you can make those management decisions, the marketing decisions ahead of time. And we have some things we can do in the adaptive management side, right? We don't have to be very prescriptive. We don't have to be static. We just don't have to put our heads in the sand and say, this is how we've always done it. Four key things I think here emerge. One is, boy, we're dealing with drought. If there's ways to help predict it with some forecasting tools, that gives us an advantage. Right? Because everybody else is waiting for the drought to come. Hopefully you're being proactive and seeing some of the triggers and seeing that drought start to emerge. And we'll showcase some of those towards the end of this presentation. Two, do you have some flexibility to adjust your numbers? Are you pretty much constrained in your operation with what you have? Now, if you have some ability to adjust it, can you adjust the total numbers up and down? Can you adjust your grazing season length? What can you do to increase that flexibility in your operation that gives you an advantage in these sorts of turbulent times in terms of both forage production and the market conditions? Three, and we know a lot of Wyoming ranchers already do this, about half of them employ conservative stocking. You're not going to get the great years when you have extra forage, but you're going to save that forage and then use it in years henceforth after that that become dry and forage becomes limiting. So essentially you're banking from year to year because of that. And four, if you have spatial variability on your ranch, if you're big enough, right, where you can have some sort of ability where rain may hit on certain parts of your ranch and you can move cattle around. If you have topographic variability, you can go from floors, meadows, maybe up into the mountains and take advantage of that. Or if you're spread out like some ranchers are, where you have ranches in different counties and different states, can you move the animals around to where the forage supply is sufficient? And again, this is going to be individual decision-making, but it's perceptions of how you can distinguish your ranch from other operators and perhaps glean an economic advantage for your operation. So I spent some time here talking about lenses, perceptions, what's going on in terms of looking at similar horizons from an individual standpoint. What kind of tools can we add to the toolbox? Well, number one is, guess what? All of us in here are experts if we can make it rain because drought lessens. Wow. Take home message number one. Okay? That always happens, right? When a drought comes, all we need is one more rain. But what are some things we can look at that gives us some tools in that toolbox in terms of current conditions, some outlooks, seasonal precipitation or temperature forecast? And then we're going to spend some time about some of these longer-term climatological influences. We're now just starting to wrap our hands around because we have the data capacity to look at what happens on really longer-term timescales. So here we are. How many people look at the U.S. Drought Monitor on a religious basis? Pretty regular? All right, several folks. A great resource, right? This is from the National Drought Mitigation Center, headquartered out there in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Here's the current conditions. Just released last Thursday. It's updated weekly. And guess what? For those of you up in the Dakotas and Montana, it's still dry, right? It's not rocket science. It tells you that. But what we're starting to see is some emergence of drought down in the desert southwest. Lots of Texas, the Ozark country, and the southeast part of the U.S. is dry or abnormally dry. Gives you some ideas in terms of marketing decisions, where cattle might be coming from, where prices could be impacted. It also gives you an idea in terms of not only current conditions, but the same location, you can get this, an outlook. You can get the monthly outlook. I picked the three-month outlook. So this is up through February. What do we see happening on the entire U.S. basis? Well, guess what? Those of you in western South Dakota, North Dakota, and eastern Montana, it doesn't look good. Dark brown means drought's going to continue to persist. There does appear to be some relief in the other parts of Montana, drought impacts lessening. We'll see why here in the next slide. We look at seasonal precipitation forecast. Look, this is pretty interesting. We're starting to see a large amount of drought development likely across the whole southeast, Texas, and the southwest. And we'll see why. There's keys because of the seasonal forecast in terms of temperature and precipitation that are driving this. Now, this is through the course of the non-growing season. This is winter. It's not abnormal to see some dry periods because guess what? We don't get a lot of rain during that time period. But this, again, gives you some indication of tools in the toolbox as you look at your management, some of your marketing decisions, and some operational flexibility you might have in your operation to take advantage of perhaps others that might be in the need of moving cattle around. So here's the seasonal forecast. For those of you who have been listening, we know that we're emerging into a La Nina period. So what does this mean in general? Predictions over the next 3 months for precipitations generally across the northern part of the U.S., above average chances of better than average precipitation. That's good news, especially for some of those drought-stricken areas. Boy, the southern half, predictions are for drier than average. Okay, that's for precipitation. On the right, we look at temperature. So if you're living up in the Dakotas and Montana, La Nina typically brings colder winters. So hopefully that doesn't happen because I know you're enjoying great winter now. And the south is expected to be, again, above average in temperature. It's no wonder then if you put the temperature plus the precipitation forecast, which are both in the wrong direction for ranchers, and that we're going to see drought conditions development likely in the desert southwest, most of Texas, and again the southeast. Some improvement again in Montana because of this additional precipitation we're expected to see with La Nina. Okay, so hopefully I've got you on board. Things are pretty easy here. Now we're going to delve off into the deep world of climatological aspects of science, and people are going to start to roll their eyes, get up, leave, go to the trade booths, etc. I'm going to try and keep you here because I think there's some new information we're starting to glean out of this really longer-term data sets that provide some insights into drought management planning. So those, anybody ever heard of the PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or AMO? This is a great audience, well, very few. So we've got a whole new thing to emerge here. These are some longer-term climate patterns that we know from the sea surface temperature. And we know the sea surface drives a lot of what happens on the continental U.S. and the other countries as well. And we have two major ones that influence our dynamics in terms of precipitation and temperature in the Great Plains. One, of course, is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. As the name implies, it's in the Pacific. And it usually operates on a fairly decadal operation. So 10 to 15, 20 years, it oscillates back and forth between what we'll call warm phases, when the water off of the Pacific Northwest is warmer than normal. And then when it goes to the cool phase, it goes backwards, and those areas become cool. And when the waters are different, we have different effects in terms of what happens in terms of our local climate patterns. The other one that has a major influence on us is the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation off, of course, the Atlantic Ocean side. And it's multi-decadal, so it's a longer-term pattern, right? This is 20 to 30 years. And so when we'll see those sorts of cycles and when those start to overlap, what sort of interactions can we have in terms of drought frequency here in the U.S.? And the good thing is we have a long-term data set on what these sort of oscillation patterns look like. Here's the one from the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Again, this is off the west coast of the Pacific. And what it shows us is back to 1900, red is when we're warm, blue is when those waters were cool. And these are monthly values. And so you have to do some interpolation, if you will, to kind of see the patterns. But here's a good period of warm, cool, warm, cool. And so we see it oscillating again about every 10-plus years. Here's the recent three phases we've been in. For those of you, go back to 1978 to 1998. So this is a long, warm phase. Right? This is that period here when things are pretty darn good in the Great Plains. Cool phase, 99 to 2013. This is largely back in here. And I'll showcase what happens in terms of when we switch that phase. And we've just recently changed 2014 back to another warm phase. So that has implications again for drought and drought management here in the U.S. This is the one pattern of the Pacific. Same pattern is on the bottom. This is the same graph we just looked at. It's a little different format. And I'm going to layer it now with the knowledge of what's happening in the Atlantic. Same year, back to 1900, and we see these longer-term patterns, right? So this is a multi-decadal, cool periods, punctuate warm period, a long cool period, another warm period. So really only four cycles in over 100 years of data up there, and a lot more cycles down in the bottom on the decadal side. So what we can do is start to match and overlap these and say, what happens if one's warm, the other's cool, warm and warm, cool and cool. We've got all those combinations. And so I've just looked at that and said, historically, guess what? We know Dust Bowl, drought years. What happened? 1930s? It's the only time in the last 100 plus years we've had both of the cycles hit the warm phase together. And what happened? Drought. Now, am I saying if those hits warm and warm again, it's going to be drought? Don't know for sure if history repeats itself, but a good trend, a good indicator of what could happen. We know that the last 15 years have been highly variable for those in the northern plains. And guess what? We've been cool and warm on from the Atlantic side, cool in the Pacific side. Opposite signals, right? So when that's happened, historically we went back and that's the same sort of pattern. High frequency of drought, a lot of interannual variability. And we look at production data and remote sensing data. We know during this period we have high coefficients of variation, a lot of variability. So we have dry years, wet years, and they go back and forth. We know overall this entire period, production was actually below long-term average. Contrast that with what happened the 15 years before, this warm period in the Pacific, we had fairly well consistent precipitation and forage production, actually higher than average forage production over that time period. So we're starting to put some trends together that gives us some insight of what happens when these sorts of cycles that happen on long time periods then start to interact with some of the things we see on a much more frequent basis. So this is really cool, but let's put it together, right? What's it mean for the ranchers? What's it mean for the ranching industry, the cattle industry, for the United States? Well, fortunately, somebody already beat us to the punch. McCabe et al., if I can get the graph to come up, looked at this and said in 2004 and looked at that long-term data and said there's really four scenarios, right? One can be warm and warm, warm and cool, cool and warm, and cold, cold. So let's systematically work through these great graphs that they did. This is A. This is the current condition when the Pacific is warm and the Atlantic is cold. So that's what we're currently in right now as of 2017. And if we look at the drought reconstruction maps, blue up there is less of an opportunity for drought, which means really favorable conditions. Red means you have a much increased above average drought frequency. So most of the U.S., if history repeats itself, is in pretty good shape regarding drought over the next, let's say, 10 to 15 years as this period works itself out. Now, the kicker is, guess what? Those of you in eastern Montana, western North Dakota, and South Dakota, you seem to be in one of those target spots where it looks like it could be a bad decade plus. Parts of Wyoming as well. Now, contrast, that's what we're merging into. D, here's where we just were. Basically, 2000 through 2013, we had a cold cycle in the Pacific, warm over in the Atlantic. Wow, and red says that's a really good spot for droughts. Guess what? We had those, right? Now, not every year, right? But the frequency of drought was increased during that decade-plus time period, right? Remember, 2000? 2002, 4, 6, 8. Seemed like those even years were just habitual for drought. 2010, maybe 2012 whacked us on the head, right? Those of you over in the South Dakota side, boy, you've been pretty good lucky. Because again, those were conditions, perhaps, by these climatological patterns where you didn't have the increased frequency of drought. This is cool information. Now let's take a step back in time. Remember, we looked at that graph and said, when did the Dust Bowl occur? 1930s? Warm and warm. The only time, again, in the last 120-plus years where we've had those sort of signals consistently overlap. What is the prediction? Boy, that looks like 1930s, doesn't it? Drought across the heartland. Lots of the U.S. in drought. And so could we see that signal again? Sure we can, because we know those cycles at some point are going to overlap enough to where we have a warm on both the Pacific and the Atlantic side. And what about the other scenario? What if we get cold and cold? Right? Don't we haven't really talked about that. But this is the mid-60s to mid-1970s is the most recent time period we've seen for this. Basically, the central and northern part of the southern Great Plains are in increased frequency of drought, and the rest of the U.S. is in pretty good shape. All right. So let's start thinking about this again, right? We just went from cold and warm. That's where we were. This cold has went warm. This has went cold. How's it going to cycle? We know that the Atlantic, right, cycles multi-decadal, so it's slower. Pacific's going to cycle every 10 to 15 years, likely. So if the Atlantic's going to stay cold, and this is going to turn back cold, this is likely the conditions, if the cycles hold true, that we're probably going to see in the 2020s to 2030. Okay? So if I'm sitting here today thinking about my longer-term drought management, here's where I am today, probably for the next 10 years plus, right? If history repeats itself, here's likely where we're going next after that time period. Okay. So we start to see that there are some ways in which big data, which history repeats itself, that we can look in terms of drought management, right? And we know at some point, probably our children or grandchildren are going to be faced with this sort of thing when the two cycles interrupt and we end up being warm, warm again. So this is really cool information to be able to glean from some of the historical records, looking at the influence of sea temperatures on drought frequency. And it gives us another tool, again, in that toolbox that we can use to help plan for drought. It doesn't have to sneak up and bite us in the rear end like it typically seems to do when droughts occur. All righty, so what's coming? So Everybody likes a grand premiere. We've been working with some of this data in conjunction with the Drought Mitigation Center, Brian Fuchs and his group over there, Bill Parton, who's one of the eminent scientists at Colorado State University, well-known ecologist and a modeler. And we've taken data from 1982 when we started remote sensing with satellites in the atmosphere and paired it with a lot of on-the-ground data and said, we know historically now we have 30-plus years of data across the entire world. We just picked out the Great Plains here and said, we've got some relationships between greenness that can be sensed from the satellite, production on the ground. We have very good models that can predict forage production if we have good inputs, and we have better short-term predictions. So we started in the spring here of 2017 and said, let's put this data together in a forecastability manner to maybe help producers. And so by June 12th, we had produced a map for several of us to look at and said, if we could predict forage production in a county, would it be beneficial for decision-making? And we said, what would producers want to see? Probably a relative basis. So by June 12th of this year, we had predicted dryness here. So this is 20% less production or more. Getting into the Dakotas and Montana, we'd hit it square on. And we'd also predicted where it had been above average forage production. Now, June 12th isn't great because guess what? That's probably too late for a lot of decision making. We're hoping to push it back earlier, perhaps into May. But this sort of data now exists. We'll roll this out next spring. This is, so you see it in the trade magazines. You talk to your extension folks. Talk to NRCS. We're going to be pushing this out as, again, a tool to help you with decision-making. It won't be at the county level. Our plans are to go down to the sub-county level, hopefully down to a couple square miles if we can, to give you this sort of predictive forecast every couple weeks. All right, so take-home messages, right? This is all, folks. What do we check off today? I hope that you looked at this and said, we have horizons out there. We all see the same horizon, but our perceptions are through the lenses either experimental or experiential knowledge that we have. We have some planning we can do for drought, right? And it can be iterative, and we need to continually look at that drought plan and communicate it with our entire enterprise. What's a flexibility I can add back to my operation to help drought-proof my ranch, to increase the resiliency so I don't have to go through these ups and down cycles like we do with most droughts? How adaptive can I be? What's my flexibility in terms of matching forage production with those animal numbers? Do I have some things I can utilize to my advantage? And hopefully I've given you some information on some key tools that you can use short-term, the current conditions, some of the seasonal forecasts, which are improving all the time, and some of these longer-term climatic patterns, which gives us a glimpse, at least into what we think the predictions will occur over longer periods, decades to multi-decades. With that, I want to thank Wyoming. When I moved here in 2002, went down to courthouse, of course, and got my new license plates, randomly, and I'm not sure if this is randomly, got assigned this number for my pickup. Thought it was kind of ironic, 1934, of course, the worst drought year ever recorded in the U.S., and they gave it to the new range scientist guy and said, thank you very much. So I continue to have the legacy. I have the plate. I always have this plate. But again, I want to thank Wyoming for reminding me that my interest as a range manager is not only the good times, but how to get through the drought management side. So with that, Mike, I'll close my presentation.